From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today we discussed this past week's UN General Assembly General Debate with international political analyst Mark Sloboda, who's a senior lecturer at Moscow State University. Okay, Mark, well, the annual general debate at the UN General Assembly had some interesting characters. We had Trump's debut on the first day of the happenings, and yesterday, Thursday, we had foreign ministers of China and Russia, among many other speakers. Let's kick some of that around, some of the other things that have been going on in the last week.
Yeah, so Don, thanks for having me. It's always an honor and a pleasure to be on CPR.
Our pleasure.
I look at a president's first UNGA speech as kind of a rite of passage that you are truly a statesman. It's kind of like having your cherry popped. If our female audience will will forgive the vulgarity there. I think a lot of people were really looking forward to the Trump show at the UNGA. I know I certainly was. And he did not fail to deliver what is the hallmark of him long before he became president: entertainment value.
That's right.
But I think it's also interesting to note who was not there in terms of heads of state.
Right. President Xi and President Putin were not there.
Xi and Putin were not there. The Prime Minister of India was not there.
Right, Modi,
the
right.
Chancellor of Germany was not there.
Right.
Macron was there because this is his first rodeo, too, although he did it to much less fanfare.
Right.
The Prime Minister of the UK was there. Although from what I've seen, she spoke to a largely empty UNGA when she spoke.
That was her debut too, right?
Yes. Yeah. So it was quite of an embarrassment and a reminder of how far in importance in world affairs the mighty British Empire has fallen from its once glorious days.
Yep.
But I enjoyed both of Trump's speeches. By that, I don't mean – he also spoke at committee on reform of the UN sitting beside Nikki Haley.
Right.
In case it needs any reminder, the UN's ambassador to the UN is Nikki Haley, Southern Republican who has no experience or education whatsoever in foreign policy or international affairs or international security or anything of that like.
Oh, I think that she worked on an agreement with the neighboring Georgia and Carolina to work out like reciprocity agreements for DMV or stuff like that. That's the extent of reform policy.
That's my point. She has, across state boundaries for her is widening her geopolitical horizons.
Yeah, right. That's right. I can see Georgia from my house.
I am convinced along the way. See, I believe that Nikki Haley was tossed to the neocons as a bone. And I believe she was put in the, as the UN, U.S. Secretary of the UN, primarily because Trump doesn't care what happens at the United Nations.
Right.
And we have seen multiple occasions to this point where she has been reprimanded by Tillerson. She seems to elevate herself and put her on the same position of Secretary of State. Mm-hmm. And because the liberal media that is so far in bed with the neocons that you can no longer even tell the difference have glommed on to Nikki Haley as bringing back the glory days of the U.S. moralizing and lecturing to the world under Samantha Powers and previous presidencies. They love her. They continually ask, "Will you be Secretary of State? Do you want to be Secretary of State?"
Yeah.
Why? Because they want her to be Secretary of State because Tillerson's more laid back, less press heavy, less preachy and moralizing on human rights, you know, hypocritically moralizing on human rights and other things, that rubs them the wrong way. That really doesn't view adhere to their ideological view of America's place in the world. So Tillerson is a big disappointment for them.
Yeah.
Even if he is one of the only adults at the table that is not a U.S. general.
Yeah.
But
he ran ExxonMobil, and Nikki Haley ran South Carolina for a minute.
Let's all agree that we're not happy that the president of ExxonMobil is our Secretary of State. Of course, that's a huge conflict of interest. And you know, the implications with climate change and everything, but even Rex Tillerson has been more honest with the realities of climate change than Trump. So I guess we have to take with what we can.
Yeah.
Nikki Haley is an embarrassment, and I haven't seen her do anything except crib from Samantha Power's notes.
Yeah.
And try to be her. It's pretty embarrassing, and I don't think anyone else at the big table takes her seriously.
Let me just do a little sidebar on that point for a minute, because it's my opinion, and I want to bounce this off for you. It's my opinion that Trump is running, they all have, but in particular Trump, as the creature of the media that he is running a virtual administration with things that are what the news media will have on TV today. So you got Nikki Haley saying this at the UN and somebody else doing that here or there. And then he's got the actual administration, hampered as it is, doing the actual work, which has really nothing to do with the public narrative. That the public narrative is out there for popular or media consumption, and he's working his agenda. Do you agree with that?
I would say even identify three administrations at work here, and I mean I'm specifically talking in the realm of foreign policy. I'll leave domestic policy to those better equipped to deal with the consequences of it of Trump as domestic policy. I don't have to live there, and I have multiple times characterized his domestic policy on RT as neoliberal and odious.
Right.
And I think you can get my take from that. But on foreign policy, we've got Nikki Haley running her own show over there, maybe even four. Rex Tillerson is trying to steady the helm of state in a very understated way that has not received good reviews from the press. But I'm a little bit more sympathetic, besides the obvious contradiction of interest there. You have Trump doing his late night foreign policy via Twitter, where he's calling Kim Jong Un the leader of North Korea Rocket Man. Then he repeats it in his UNGA speech.
Right.
And let's be perfectly honest here. I seriously doubt that Kim Jong Un or any of his top advisors know the reference to Elton John and Rocket Man.
Right, right.
But to be fair, I doubt that Trump knew it either.
Right. Actually, I think that Kim Jong-un might have more than Trump because he's of a younger generation and he spent time in Europe.
I think he's just...
But whatever,
he's firing rockets. He's Rocket Man. I think that's the extent there.
But that's the red meat for...
Then
that's
we
the
have
red meat.
The fourth administration, which is the generals, the cabal of generals that are running the place. And the most obvious ones, of course, are Mattis, the Secretary of Defense.
Right.
McMaster is the National Security Advisor, the head of the National Security Council, and we have
Kelly
as Chief of Staff, the gatekeeper to Trump. Right. But it has to be remembered that there are a number of other military people who aren't necessarily high-star generals in the administration. Trump just made a major general in charge of the Federal Bureau of Prisons, the head of the CIA, Pompeo, which is, Pompeo is probably the closest thing that the administration has to a true neocon. He is a former military. Sessions was even former military. If you look through it, I mean, the administration is chock full of former military people in major in anything to do with foreign or military policy.
Yeah, in a military coup, they would have more civilians out front because they would want to front it that way.
I think than they do now. And yeah. And I do not believe Trump is really running foreign policy at this point. Now, it must be said that this cabal of generals, they are not neocons. They're not real neocons in the and I say this as a former military person myself, these and someone who is well adverse to neocons. These men are war hawks. There's no question about that. You know, they're military men and they're quick to believe that, you know, the solution to any problem is a hammer, you know, to hit on the head with a military nail.
Right.
But they are not neocons, and there is a difference in the fervency of the ideological, and the war hawks have a little bit more pragmatism and realism. Not a lot, but is much. And a big example of this is John Bolton. John Bolton has been trying to get to Trump, and he has been blocked by Kelly completely. In fact, John Bolton, you know, the infamous neocon at the UN during the Bush administration, has taken to publicly announcing in his articles that he wants to talk to Trump and is being prevented in an attempt that he might actually get to talk to Trump, which hasn't happened so far. And this brings up a very good issue, is that Trump is now completely controlled. I mean, the coup has happened. The military cabal, for better or worse, and in some ways it's, both, is now in charge. And they are completely controlling not only who sees Trump, but what Trump reads. There are multiple articles about this out there right now, about how Trump, his access to information is now completely controlled by Kelly and one other aide of his. This is the president has evidently doesn't have a browser installed on his mobile phone for some reason. Whoa. So while he can tweet, he doesn't browse the internet on it, and he doesn't have a laptop. So he gets all of his news evidently printed out and handed to him, and he has been complaining that about the lack of Breitbart and other alternative news sources. We can all think of Breitbart what we will. I take them with you know, 9/10 grain of salt, 1 out of 10. Right. They get an interesting actual report in there somewhere. But I do that with most of the media. He is being fed completely a diet of mainstream media, and he doesn't really have access to anything that they don't want him to read at this point. And the Western journalists are talking about this quite openly. It's not even, you know, they all approve of this military cabal. They approve of the CIA state that is developing around blaming Russia for the election and everything else, the security state, the CIA, the NSA, the FBI. They approve of all this. And this is perhaps really scary that the liberals are supporting the security services and a military control of the administration. Mm-hmm. There was a little red article on AP this week by Matt Lee, and also by Jonathan Lemire, how Trump's advisors schooled him on globalism. And this came out on the 18th. And they literally sat Trump down in a room in the basement of the White House and indoctrinated him on U.S. hegemony. It's said in not even any kind of equivocal terms there. If I could just read you a bit here. When briefed on the diplomatic, military, and intelligence posts, the new president would often cast doubt on the need for all the resources Defense Secretary Jim Mattis and Secretary of State Rex Tillerson organized the July 20th session to lay out the case for maintaining far-flung outposts and to present it using charts and maps, you know, pictures, in a way the businessman turned politician would appreciate.
Right.
So the session was, in effect, American Power 101, and the student was the man working the levers.
Right.
the commander-in-chief. It was part of the ongoing education of a president who arrived at the White House with no experience in the military or government and brought with him advisors deeply skeptical of what they labeled the globalist worldview, which have now all, with the possible exception of Stephen Miller, been gotten rid of one by one. In coordinated efforts and quiet conversations, some of Trump's aides have worked for months to counter that view, hoping the president can be persuaded to maintain, if not expand, the American footprint and influence abroad.
Yep.
He was indoctrinated on American hegemony. He has said repeatedly his first instance is not to send more troops to Afghanistan, and he usually goes with his first instance. But he's let Mattis have his way. He's let the generals have their way. They're running the show now. He's less than a student at this point. They only let him see who and what they want him to see and read and hear. They are making the decisions. In fact, there was a Japanese deputy foreign minister, speaking recently about the deals with North Korea. In that interview, he noticed that they've heard what Trump has said. Asked whether he was predicting war with North Korea, the former defense minister of Japan, Satoshi Morimoto, said, "I think Washington has not decided. Whoa. The final decision maker is Mr. Mattis, not the president." And yeah, that's who we're waiting to hear from.
Yeah, I saw that. You know, and by the way, what you were just reading from before this piece, the AP, Washington Post piece, the very next paragraph says that all of that is going to become apparent at the UN General Assembly at its first address, and we got a chance to see that earlier. So, yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry. I just wanted to, because when we get to
it's very important. And when I'm talking about two speeches at the UN that Trump gave, there was one speech where Trump actually gave a rather interesting and very un-American hegemony defense of sovereignty. Sovereignty is a word that has rubbed multiple administrations completely wrong since they've done their absolute best to erode the principle.
Yep.
In favor of what the term human rights intervention, R2P, the rights to protect, right? All of this selective hypocritical that is used to justify Western, U.S.-led Western hegemony around the world and knocking off governments one after the other.
Right.
Not, of course, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Bahrain, but, you know, the ones that don't align with foreign policy. Whereas this humanitarianism is not a principle, it's a pretext.
Yeah.
Principle means you uphold it when it's difficult, when it costs you your own interests, not when you only do it, when it aligns with what is politically and geopolitically convenient for
you. There was a very Bannonite or Bannonesque framing of the issue of sovereignty that he presented there, too. And what's interesting is that it's ironic that it's at the United Nations, because you have all of these transnational groupings that have been constructed riding on the back of a claim of democracy, when what you're doing in essence is, in the places where democracy or something resembling it exists, you're stripping away the power of those governments to do actions on behalf of the people in favor of these transnational structures that are not democratic at all. There's never an election that I get to vote in for the head of the UN or even my representative at the UN. That is totally...
Or even far more than the UN. Let's talk the IMF.
Right. Yeah.
The World
Bank. All of it.
Right?
Yeah, right.
All of these financial economic levers that wield so much hidden power around the world that aren't even democratic among the big states sitting at the table. That is one of the big arguments from Russia and China and India's and others, is that they have far less voting rights or quotas at these Bretton Woods developed institutions than their economic size and strength would warrant, which continues Western control of the world. But in that first part of his speech, Trump mentioned the word sovereignty 18 times, where you would be hard-pressed to hear Obama ever say the word at all, or you know, previous leaders. And that rubbed a lot of people the wrong way. But then there was the second part of his speech, which that part of his speech had to almost, first of all, it completely contradicted the first part of his speech, but it also was sure to make the neocons happy after they were, you know, after they were probably disenchanted of hearing that horrible, horrible word sovereignty mentioned. Then he went on the usual, the latest U.S. axis of evil harangue, where he completely went against what he said about sovereignty and talked about violating the sovereignty of his latest host of enemy countries. Right. And on Trump's axis of evil list that he harangued, there were North Korea, of course, which he threatened to destroy North Korea, of course, if North Korea launched an attack on the U.S. or one of its allies. Yeah, we've seen this. We've seen the Gulf of Tonkin. We've seen weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. We've seen this play before. Mm-hmm. The U.S. never launches wars. It's always the underdog, authhritarian leader of a country that isn't foreign policy aligned with the United States that launches a suicidal attack. It's never the U.S., of course. So it was North Korea. Cuba makes the list again after being off of it for a long time. Venezuela, which Trump, of course, went on a harangue against socialism.
Right.
And not that Venezuela really approaches real socialism in any way, shape, or form.
That was red meat for his base again.
Yeah, of course, absolutely, for his base. Yeah. In fact, the very way he talked about it. Yeah. And the other was Syria, of course. And then he talked about the murderous criminal regime. And evidently he wasn't talking about Obama's employment of illegal arming, trading, and salarying of sectarian militants allied with and embedded with Al-Qaeda. He was speaking of Bashar al-Assad somehow. Because when I hear criminal murderous regime, I have to say that the guy who is one implausible degree of separation away from directly supporting Al-Qaeda and ISIS, Obama, that's what I think of when I think of a bloody and criminal regime.
Right.
So, but that's just me personally.
And also this, on that same point, Caleb Maupin showed this kind of stuff pretty well in a piece, where Obama, the General Assembly before the destruction of Libya, in other words, September of 2010, flowery, peacey language and stuff, and then he started and finished the Libyan war the following year and started the Syrian war, which still rages, among other things. He didn't say, talk nicey-nice, but he did that. Trump's talking mean, but we don't know what he's going to do yet.
Yes. So, after Trump was done this speech, and like I said, it was almost as if it was two different speeches, we hope that the better angels of Trump's nature were responsible for the first part, and we hope that the worst temptations that he would be led to are not actually implemented in the second part, and that it's just usual bluster. It has to be remembered that Trump is hardly the first one to resort to violent bombast at the UNGA. Mm-hmm. President Obama put it directly in his UNGA remarks. He called Russia a threat to global security directly between Ebola and ISIS.
Right.
He also promised that he had nuclear weapons that could destroy North Korea if necessary. We always remember it when Trump says it, but somehow it seems milder and much more friendly when Obama threatens to destroy a state than when Trump threatens to do it. But At this point, we have to hope in the restraint, such as it is, of the military cabal, and then that, in some ways, particularly when it comes to Iran, might actually be more optimistic. Like I said, it's a for better and worse situation with these generals now running the foreign and military policy of the country.
I think the objectives, whatever the settled objectives become of the foreign policy, and you paint a kind of a scary picture. That article paints kind of a scary picture that the policies being set by this group of deep staters as opposed to that. In other words, the question of hegemony does not appear to be off the table. You know,
no, it's not on the table. It is never on the table. That is the most important thing that you should draw from the Trump administration.
Right.
The biggest problem that they had with him is not his crazy racist friends or supporters, misogyny. However you want to term it. It's not his neoliberal bunch wanting to privatize off the Department of Energy or other things. The problem they had with Trump is he threatened U.S. hegemony. In fact, we have seen leaks online from reported in the mainstream press of what supposedly was Obama's final turnover letter to Trump. And in it, one of the big thing that he lectured him on was the need to maintain U.S. leadership of the world. The world needs it. And there was an article in Foreign Policy just over a month ago where a deep stater made a defense of the deep state, of the leaks, and asked that these leaks not be pursued. And he said that these career bureaucrats, all of them also ideologically driven to a degree, the way it's presented here, they would obey reasonable commands of a president of a commander in chief of a president.
Reasonable commands.
Reasonable, and meaning that adhere to their foreign policy view of the world, the hegemony that the U.S. has in place.
So when you were in the military,
this was questioned.
When you were in the military, if you told your commanding officer, "I'm going to obey your every reasonable command," how long do you get in a brig for just bringing that up?
I don't imagine. I it would go past my service date. I'm quite sure. And I served 6 years.
Okay.
So it doesn't happen except in this deep state. These not just Pentagon, often civilian security, State Department, and others that are not elected, who think that they know best. And that U.S. policing the world, leading the world, judge, jury, and executioner of the world, hegemon of the world, however you want to term it, at enormous cost to U.S. taxpayers, more than 1,000 foreign military bases. I mean, they sat Trump down and they explained to him why this is necessary. Mm. And he's like, well, do we really need 1,000 foreign military bases all around the world and far-flung locations, as it was put? And they explained, yes, we do, Mr. Trump, with pictures illustrated.
Yep.
So it's just not up for option. I mean, that is, you're allowed to have differences on domestic policy, identity politics, all of this sort of thing, even ones as radical divisive as Trump's. But foreign policy, that you cannot touch.
Wow.
That you cannot touch. That is where U.S. democracy is. You're not allowed to touch the foreign policy. And amazingly enough, that's what they criticize countries like Russia for.
Yeah.
Where Russia has one main, shall we say, party of power, while the U.S. has two, United Russia. But there are two smaller but still substantial parties, well, three actually, the Communist Party of the Russian Federation, the Liberal Democratic Party of Russia, around
Zhirinovsky,
Duma member Zhirinovsky, which is not liberal, not democratic, not really a party, it's a cult of personality.
Right.
It's a lightning rod for the soft nationalists, soft nationalists, to keep them from becoming following some real ideological nationalists, and a fair Russia party, which is the smallest of the parties of the Duma, which is a moderate Russian-orientated social democratic party. But all of these parties are regarded by the West as not legitimate opposition parties because they largely support the foreign policy of the current Russian administration. So they're not legitimate opposition. They're just fake parties.
And that is sort of the nexus point where they're in the same boat as Trump in relation to this group that sets global foreign policy, and we'll have to pick it up there next. Yeah, we'll pick it up there next week, Mark. Thank you very much for your time. Appreciate it. Talk to you next week.
Thanks for having me, Don.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.